John Friend. All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also write for The Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage all listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications if you are not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for more details. All right, with that said, let me introduce my special guest today. Jared Howe of JaredHowe.net is joining me today. Jared hosts a podcast program called So to Speak and presents from an alt-right, racial realist, libertarian perspective. Jared, welcome to the program, sir. How are you this morning?
Well, it's good to be with you, man. Thanks for having me.
Yes, of course. Thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it. Happy St. Paddy's Day.
Indeed.
Yes, it's great to have you on. I've been following your work for a while now and listening to your podcast, especially since Cantwell started syndicating it. I've always been a big fan of Cantwell ever since I discovered him, probably in 2016, I think it was, like early 2016. I heard him on The Right Stuff, and I've been following his work ever since, and I know you collaborated with him when he was locked up down in Charlottesville. I've kind of been following you since then, and I'm very impressed, so I'm very glad to have you on.
Well, thanks, man. I think that's kind of funny that you say that you found Cantwell through The Right Stuff, because I come at things from kind of an opposite angle, where I discovered The Right Stuff through Cantwell. And actually, I started looking into TRS back when I was at beinglibertarian.com, which is their presence is primarily on Facebook. They reach like 500,000 people there. That's where I used to have a podcast. And back when I was still over there, we were planning on having a debate between Christopher Chase Rachels and Jazz Hands McFeels from over at Fash the Nation. And Halberstram and I were going to co-moderate that debate, but then Doxgate happened over at TRS. So when all that went down, I was in the process of researching that debate, and I had previously heard of TRS through Cantwell, so everything just kind of clicked. Got into their content, and I haven't stopped listening to it since. I'm still a pretty big fan of TRS.
I really enjoy the Daily Show. I was like, I know it's, I wanted to say the Death Panel for some reason, the Daily Show. I've been following that show for a while, and a lot of the other shows as well. I think they do great work. And I guess you kind of got into it. I wanted you to kind of start and talk about your background and how you got involved with the libertarian movement and how you started podcasting and your website and stuff like that. So could you kind of maybe just give us a brief overview of how you got involved in all this stuff?
Yeah, it's a long story. Maybe I could try to give you the short version, though. Back about, I want to say probably about 10 or 15 years ago, I started getting into the whole 9/11 truth movement, which got me skeptical of government. It was the George W. Bush administration at the time. Not only skeptical of government, but also skeptical of Jewish power in general. I wasn't aware at the time of what I've come to know now as an anti-white agenda, but I was still hip to the idea that the Jews were in control of the media and the banks. They were captains of industry, and this wasn't really an effect of meritocracy, right? So I came into it from the 9/11 truth type angle, but while I was researching that, I became kind of anti-war, and that led me to Ron Paul. So back, I think 2007, 2008, I got involved with just promoting Ron Paul's presidential campaign at the time, not in any official capacity, but as like a grassroots promoter, I guess you could say. And then in 2012, I became a delegate in my state for the Ron Paul Party, in which Ron Paul actually won my state. But if you weren't around at the time, it's hard to convey to you just how disheartening this would have been. But he won the state that I was in and wasn't allowed to be, our delegates weren't allowed to be seated at the Republican National Convention because they said we cheated. It was Mitt Romney's lawyers or something. So at that time, I became pretty disenchanted with politics in general, and I kind of dropped out of it a bit. And I used to play like guitar in metal bands, and at that time I'd stopped playing music too, and instead focused, well, I wanted to continue playing music, but I didn't have anybody to play music with. You know, people grow up, the people I was playing in a band with had kids, that sort of thing. So I started making hip hop for like voluntarist, like anarchist, libertarian type hip hop. And I figured, you know, I need to find some way to promote this, like an audience to promote this to. And that led me back to the libertarians and the anarchists and things. And what ended up happening is I got pretty involved with the online community there. Eventually had a podcast at an outfit called the Seed the Liberty that didn't last very long. I got kicked out there by the Jew in control. He didn't like my helicopter jokes. But then I was doing Backwards Live, another it was a podcast, but it was kind of like a blood sports type format live show on Facebook with Eric July, where I would debate just random people. And actually, by the end of the show, it turned into just me debating random libertarians on why closed borders are preferable to open borders. But then I got kicked out of Being Libertarian for criticizing communism as a implicitly Jewish ideology. And a lot of the people that run Being Libertarian are Jewish. They didn't really like that. So I got kicked out of there, which left me with not very many options at that point. Now, I've, you know, always been aware of Cantwell. I'd been listening to his content up until that point. So he seemed like a natural ally following my ouster from all the libertarian institutions that had driven me out. I had been following through TRS and through his content the developments leading up to the Unite the Right rally last year, and I was pretty black-pilled when Cantwell got arrested. So I made myself available so that his voice would continue to be heard while he was in jail. I know that I've skipped past the just the explanation of how I got into libertarianism, but yeah, I mean, that's...
No, that's cool. That's very interesting. So you've been in this since, you said, like, 07, you really started kind of getting into 9/11 Truth and stuff like that. So it's been over 10 years.
Well, I mean, I started getting into, like, 9/11 Truth, like, 2004, 2005. Wow. Yeah, and then it was 2007 when I became political.
Okay. Can I ask you, I'm curious, how old are you?
I'm 30.
Okay. I'm 32, so we're similar in age. Okay, wow. So you were young and getting involved in this and questioning 9/11. You know, it's interesting. I sort of have a similar story. I mean, I didn't come at it really from like the libertarian angle, but my big wake up call was also researching 9/11. And prior to that, I was already pretty skeptical of the government and of the media. I was actually really like a big Ralph Nader supporter in 2008 when he was running for president. So I was very much against the established political parties and stuff like that. And then I started researching 9/11, and that led to questioning and really doing more research into Jewish power, which led to Holocaust revisionism and racial realism and everything else, you know, where we're at today. So
sure.
It's interesting. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on 9/11? Are you still kind of like a 9/11 truther?
Well, I don't know.
I don't like that term. I'm kind of using it like as a joke, but... Are you a 9/11 skeptic?
Maybe 15 years ago, I would have been able to argue against the official narrative of 9/11 more succinctly than I'm capable of doing so today. I haven't really invested much time in it recently, and it's something I used to care a lot about. Like, I used to think, you know, if we could just get the truth about 9/11 out, then we could get, you know, white people to care about themselves, white people to care about government corruption, or Americans to care about government corruption. What I found was that people are generally unwilling to discuss it and typically will write you off as a crazy tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist for even daring to broach the topic. So I've kind of the utility, I haven't seen much utility in that particular argument myself, but I guess I would still say that I'm skeptical of the official narrative. Yeah, I think I would put myself probably more in the let it happen camp, let it happen on purpose rather than made it happen on purpose. And I'm inclined to think that it was it may have been, you know, Arabs that carried it out, but I'm fairly certain that it was Israelis that funded it. So I mean, that's about where I'm at, and it's probably something that we could, you know, look further into in the future once we have more pressing matters taken care of, like immigration. But sure. Yeah,
no, I hear you. I used to talk about 9/11 and write about 9/11 and do podcasts about 9/11 all the time, and I haven't really talked about it too much in probably the past couple years at least. I still think it's a very important topic. I mean, I think the official narrative explaining 9/11 really is the paradigm that our current foreign policy is formulated in. You know, all these wars in the Middle East, it really all kind of goes back to 9/11. And I've always said, and I still believe this to this day because I think we can easily prove it, that Jews were responsible for 9/11 from top to bottom, and they've certainly benefited from it. The State of Israel, especially, you know, our whole foreign policy is designed to advance Israeli hegemony in the region using our troops and using our money.
That's one of the things it's designed to do. One of the other things it's designed to do is maintain a global hegemony on the circulation of currency, right? It's to protect the dollar's reserve status. But at the same time, that's still just another another way of saying protecting Jewish interests, because it's Jews that are in control of the reserve banks, right, for the most part. So it's – and I agree with you almost everything you just said, but I would further stipulate that it's not necessarily that 9/11 is the cause of all these wars in the Middle East, because the wars in the Middle East were ongoing before 9/11 happened. 9/11 was really just a means by which to justify them in perpetuity. It was the catalyst for the war on terror. And the war on terror is really just a front for, like you said, fighting for Jewish interest in the Middle East, whether it be for Israel's interest or for, like I said, the interest of the central bank, which you got to think, man, from the perspective of anybody, but from the perspective of Jews especially, if you have a global monopoly on the circulation of currency, you can just create it from nothing. I mean, that's like playing real life with a game genie, if you get the reference. It's like playing video games on God mode. It's not even remotely fair. It's a form of theft, and I think the Jews, it's probably one of the most coveted powers that the Jews have, is to create money from nothing and lend it to the fucking goyim at interest.
Yes, absolutely. And researching 9/11 kind of led me down these paths, exactly what you're saying, you know, the Jewish control of the Federal Reserve and international banking and finance in general. And it really is one of the main pillars of Jewish power. But I've often argued that even more important is their control of the media. And this was something I learned, you know, researching 9/11 truth, was discovering just the total dominance of Jews in the media. I mean, it's really, they call it like an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory or an anti-Semitic canard, when it's just an easily observable and easily demonstrable fact that Jewish individuals control the media, a lot of the people we see in the media are Jewish themselves. You know, there's a number of prominent Jewish journalists and news presenters, et cetera. And the ownership is certainly Jewish. And
well, if you notice multiple, these things, you get gaslit. They're just more naturally intelligent. But it's like, well, wait a second. There's more high IQ white people than there are Jews, period. So you don't see the same distributions of like if you looked at like high school performance, right? You see a certain amount of whites graduating at the top of their class. You don't see those percentages represented in the business world, because you do see things in the business world like what Huffington Post is public about. We have a quota to hire less white people, right? Like, this is something that genuinely happens. So it's not just that Jews are beating everybody else meritocratically in the market, but they'll gaslight you and say that That's what's happening when you notice that Jews are overrepresented in the media. Jews are overrepresented in the banking industry. And yeah, I think you're right. I think maybe it is. I don't know if more important that they have a monopoly on the media, but it's definitely part of the problem. And I think
for sure,
part of the reason why they're so scared of social media, why we get this, so much of this, you know, everybody who disagrees with me is a Russian bot and we need to shut it down. And this is something that I noticed with, you know, as far back as the Ron Paul movement, like especially in 2012, like the reason Ron Paul was able to do an end run around the Jewish media is because of grassroots organizers on social media. And I think that was also instrumental for Donald Trump's success too. So I think the Jews are noticing this. They've had an effective hegemony on the media and control of information for more than three decades. And this is all coming to an end right now. So they're trying to adapt and make it so that the internet is developed in such a way that they can continue controlling the flow of information. Even activists within the alt-right movement still frame their action in terms of what's going to get me the most publicity on Jewish-run media. And I think that's I think it goes to show you the degree to which they have maintained absolute control over time. So it's unfortunate that things like Facebook and Twitter are so heavily censored, but I don't know, maybe it's a market opportunity for alternative services like Gab and Minds, you know?
Yes, I sure hope so, because you're right. I mean, they have basically maintained a stranglehold over information, over political opinion, political perspectives, and certainly over narratives that shape our paradigm for understanding the world. When it comes to our historical paradigm, I think I've often argued that our basic historical paradigm is framed from the perspective of the fake Holocaust story and the official narrative of World War II, which is a weaponized narrative of history designed to advance Jewish power and discredit white interests and really attack our race. That's what it's all about. And I mean, 9/11,
sorry to interrupt. I'm bad about that.
No, go ahead. No, it's okay. I mean, they've controlled the narratives, and they're seeing cracks in that with social media, with blogging. I mean, when I first started, you know, talking on the internet about these things, I just created a simple Blogspot account, you know, and started writing my thoughts down, started doing podcasts, and, you know, eventually sort of gained a following. And that's, you know, that's basically what the internet is all about. You can get on there, set up your own platform, express yourself, publish information, talk about what's important to you. And, you know, that's a very revolutionary thing, I think.
Well, yeah, it causes an emperor has no clothes type moment, right? Because then people start picking apart the creation myths of the Holocaust, the creation myths of the indigenous genocide, of colonialism, of slavery. All these things, what do they have in common? They're used to confer the original sin of white privilege, or projected onto white people. Say, you are guilty for all of this historical oppression, right? You bear the blood guilt of crimes of the past, of your ancestors, and you need to pay reparations for it. You need to make amends for it. But all these narratives are very paper thin, which is why they need it's why they needed a monopoly on the production of education, right? That's why Jews needed to control our education system. So now you have things like the internet where anybody can go and get conflicting perspectives and enough different perspectives where they can kind of put information to, you know, together for themselves. And they start to see, hey, wait a minute, a little napkin math reveals that we couldn't have possibly burned this many Jews in these ovens in such short a period of time. And you know, it really goes from there. And that's why they need to ban questioning the Holocaust in places like Germany. And it's why they want to ban hate speech in places like Canada and America and even all over Europe, right? Because once you can start questioning these narratives, once you can start asking questions, pointing out facts, it's all over.
Absolutely. I mean,
they need a veil.
Well, and now we see how they're openly collaborating with Google and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube to basically censor politically incorrect, you know, opinions. I mean, even like moderate sort of like conservative thought, you know, they're going after people. So it really is sort of like this Jewish tyranny That's masquerading as tolerance and diversity and multiculturalism. You know, they present it as if, you know, they're like, they have like this moral authority or something, when in reality, it's simply just this Jewish tyranny that's trying to shut down anybody that's pointing this stuff out. And what was really incredible for me when I was kind of getting into this, I started reading like David Duke, Kevin MacDonald, and a number of other people, but those two in particular, I read like Mein Kampf and started getting into revisionism. And it was incredible just following like the explicitly Jewish press, like the Jewish Daily Forward, for example, or the Times of Israel, or the Jewish Telegraph Agency, like reading what Jews themselves were saying, like following the press releases of the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center, because they just openly admit all this stuff. They openly admit how they're collaborating with YouTube, for example, how they're training law enforcement, FBI agents, you know, our military, they're indoctrinating them with this Holocaust bullshit and all this multiculturalism nonsense and diversity, etc. So, I mean, they're basically openly admitting what their agenda is. They're openly admitting how they're behind open borders, how they're behind the promotion and elevation of homosexuality and transgenderism. Openly admitting this, openly admitting that they're behind the gun grab, you know, this assault on the Second Amendment. And yet, if you point this out, they call you a racist, a conspiracy theorist, an anti-Semite, when they themselves are basically saying everything that we're saying. We're just pointing it out and being critical of it and exposing how, you know, how anti-white they are and how openly hostile to our race that they are. It's really, really incredible when you stop and think about it.
No, they'll always gaslight you over it. And every time you point out a space where there's friction between Jews and Gentiles, they'll always blame the Gentiles 100%. If you suggest that it's any less than 100% the Gentiles' fault, then you are automatically an anti-Semite. It's what Kevin MacDonald talks about in Culture of Critique, right? Even if they don't realize they're doing it necessarily, like they're still on a visceral level, they're aware of the fact that they are outsiders in a Gentiles nation. They have an outsider's mentality, and they are constantly criticizing everything. Like you see it with Christmas, right? Oh, so consumerist, right? They say the same thing about America in general. America doesn't have a real culture. It's just so consumerist. And you're right. It's very blatantly anti-white. You do get gaslight. You can get fired from your job, driven out of polite society for noticing it and pointing it out. I mean, look what happened to your previous guest, Paul Neelan. He's been ostracized from God knows how many different publications and events. Look what happened to Tom Kaczynski up in Jackman, Maine, the town manager there, who was, I mean, he was essentially fired for taking the stance that it's okay to be white and it's okay for white people to preserve their own homelands and continue to exist as white people. At some point, you realize it's like, hey, this standard where white people aren't allowed to have their own homelands, aren't allowed to advocate in their own interests. This is only being applied to white people. This is not being consistently applied to black people, Asian people, mestizos, castizos, anybody else. It's only being applied to us. And they'll admit it and they'll say, yes, but that's because of systemic oppression. That's because of your historical advantages. And what they don't want to admit is the fact that our historical advantages were informed by our biological advantages. They don't want to admit that white people evolved in winters and black people did not. We necessarily had to have lower time preference to survive. And as your time preference drops, your intelligence tends to go up. Like the process that drives down time preference also drives up intelligence. And people in Africa didn't have those incentives. They had abundantly available food. They didn't have to prepare for winter. They had a consistent, stable environment where all they had to do to survive was be faster and stronger than each other. And that's not exactly how it worked in Europe. It's not exactly how it worked in North America. Not that white people evolved in North America, but
no, I understand your point. Yeah, no, I totally understand your point. I think you're right. And you know, another thing I've come to realize is that you know, we kind of already talked about this, but everything literally is presented from an anti-white perspective. When you're in school, all of the narratives of American history, of European history, more generally, Western civilization more generally, you know, whether it's like the founding of America with the exploitation and quote-unquote genocide of the quote unquote Native Americans, slavery, the Holocaust, colonialism, all of these narratives are, in my view, I think totally distorted and just entirely weaponized, when in reality, a much more accurate and objective understanding of our past and our accomplishments is really viewing Europeans as the creators and the creators of civilization and the explorers of the world. You know, I mean, we brought civilization to the world. And I think all of these ideas that we were like out there exploiting people and murdering people and genociding people, I don't think a lot of it is true, first off.
Well, no, it's not.
You know what I mean? It's not. It's
right.
Just
every,
not true.
Every narrative they tell you in public school has two objectives. Objective one, get white kids to hate themselves. Objective two, get non-whites to hate white kids. That's all it is, right? And not only are these narratives not true the vast majority of time, you look at something like slavery, you find that the slavers, the vast majority of them, were not white, they're Jewish or they're African, right? So it's not,
yeah,
and then you
exactly.
say less than 3% of Americans own slaves, and they want you to believe that America's prosperity is the result of slaves picking cotton, as though picking cotton can drive an industrial revolution, right? It's just the most ridiculous and absurd shit ever, where they present something that literally every race has done throughout history and only white people have had the decency to stop doing, and then they say that it makes white people worse than everybody else. They only do that because we react to shame and because we will pay people off. Like, oh, stop calling me a racist. Oh God. Have some
yes.
welfare money, have
yes.
some reparations, have some housing vouchers, have every fucking advantage in the world, to the point where we're in $21 trillion of national debt and still say that we're fucking evil, still say that we're holding black people back after 50 fucking years of selling our children, our unborn children, into national debt for their fucking benefit. At some point, you have to call it a wash. The sunken cost fallacy. $21 trillion in debt and $75 trillion and unfunded liabilities, probably more. You have to understand, maybe no amount of investment's going to bridge the gaps that evolution created. Maybe we should just cut our fucking losses.
Yes, very well said. And I think a lot of it stems from white people just failing to stand up and have like moral clarity, moral authority on these issues. Because, I mean, it does take some research. I mean, and if you do, like, for example, with slavery, it's interesting. You can go back and read a lot of the accounts of slaves when slavery was ending, and they were, a lot of them, you know, you can read this in their own diaries, they're expressing sadness and sorrow that they're being, you know, basically emancipated and freed from their slave owner, who actually took care of them and provided them a job and a place to live. And, you know, so my argument is that slavery itself was not this like evil, violent institution. Largely, I think you can make the argument that it was benevolent, and you know, we were basically taking care of these people and providing them a stable source of you know, productive work to do, and
sure.
it was almost like they were part of the family. They were treated, it was like a worker. I mean, that's basically what it was.
I think
so. I reject the whole narrative outright, you know, that it was this evil, monstrous institution and white people were like raping slaves and murdering them. That's just not how we are. I mean, maybe it happened from time to time.
Well, I'm sure it happened.
It's not, that's you. Not, that's not how slavery really was. I think that's a totally distorted, false, and again, weaponized narrative of history used by Jews.
I highly doubt that rape was the status quo. And I think that the case could certainly be made that the American slaves were better off than their counterparts who were left back in
Absolutely.
Africa.
Absolutely. They should be thanking their lucky stars their ancestors were slaves and they're here in America. I mean, give me a break. They could be, you know, killing each other, eating each other over in Africa like they still do today.
A lot of people who do realize that, though. I think there's actually black Democratic senators who will admit that. But yeah, I don't know. You know how weaponized the narrative is, right? I mean, but for anybody who questions this, there the Jewish role of there are the Jewish role in American slavery. Just check out We Thought They Were White by Dontell Jackson, right? I mean, the information's out there for those who want to find it. The internet's censored, Google's censored, but if you want to know, you know, what really happened in American history, then you can find that information. There's really – it's actually tragic, right? You have all these woke motherfuckers out there talking about how you need to get rid of – you need to stop believing in the lies they tell you in public school, and yet they – they're fully, you know, emotionally and financially invested in those same lies. The people who will tell you that you're not woke because you're brainwashed by the government will be the first people to tell you that white people are responsible for slavery, and that we have the original sin of privilege for which we owe them reparations in perpetuity. It's ironic and tragic, but I'm past the point of wanting to correct their cognitive errors, right? Whether they're black people who believe this or white people who believe this. I understand that white people can be red-pilled, but at the end of the day, there's going to be a certain percentage of white people who won't be. And I don't want to be forced to share a system of government with those people. I don't want fucking communists and race traitors and ethno-masochists in my community having suffrage and control over other people's property, because at the end of the day, it gives them the ability to force me to import people I don't want to have anything to do with. So that's going to be the case. I don't want anything to do with them either, even if we are part of the same race.
Well said. I completely agree with you, and I've kind of jumped on board Cantwell's idea of physical removal. You know, these people need to be physically removed. I mean, you know, I know.
Well, they reject private property norms. Why should they get to appeal to the non-aggression principle in their own defense? It's bullshit. They say, well, we reject your private property and we're going to live off of your dollar, and you're going to be forced to subsidize our breeding, our education, our healthcare, our food, our housing. But then they're going to, no, you can't violate the non-aggression principle by using the government to deport us. Fuck you. You should be deported ASAP, you and your kids. Get the fuck out of here. Going back to 1965, even, I'm pretty extreme about it, because everybody who showed up since who's not white, they're here because they're beneficiaries of government intervention. And I don't think that the heirs of the country, the white Americans who are the rightful owners of this country, don't think that they should be forced to live with a government intervention. We have no obligation not to deport everybody who's, you know, doesn't believe in American nationalism the way it was intended to be, which, you know, 1776, we know who were citizens in 1776, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, America was founded explicitly by white people for white people. I mean, it's written in the founding documents. Yeah, no, I agree. I think you're making a lot of good points. And that was really, you know, you mentioned the 1965 Immigration Act. That was really kind of an eye opener for me, realizing, you know, what that was all about, who was behind it. And it's very clear it was basically the organized Jewish community working in conjunction with these, you know, race traitors like Ted Kennedy and others, you know, to fundamentally transform America from basically a white nation to this multicultural hellhole. I mean, America isn't even a nation anymore. There are multiple nations within America. It's a multiracial empire at this point, run and dominated by Jews. I mean, everything is basically designed to advance Jewish interests.
And no one ever had a chance to vote for or against it. That legislation, the 1965 Immigration Act, was passed explicitly with the promise that it was not going to change the country's demographics or culture. And look what happened. That's exactly what happened. We've gotten, 60 million people from Mexico and South America since that happened. God knows how many Muslims. America has declined from being, who were we before that? 91-92% white. Now we're, 65% white?
Maybe. Yeah, no, I think, I mean, at one point in the 60s, 90%+ white. I mean, America was known as a white country, you know, and it's been, fundamentally transformed against, you know, the wishes. We weren't even consulted, basically. I mean, that's what this is all about. This is a hostile elite doing this, using the government to advance, you know, this agenda, you know, and that kind of leads me into, I wanted to talk a little bit about libertarianism. I listened to your debate with Heimbach, which was, I think, just on Sunday night? Was it just this past Sunday? Almost a week ago now. And there have been some very tragic and bizarre developments with Heimbach and the Traditionalist Workers Party that I don't even really want to comment on. I don't know the details. I think it's just extremely bizarre what's happened, and I've met Heimbach. I've interviewed him a few times. I've always had a lot of respect for him. I think he's, you know, a pretty decent guy. But I just It's crazy what's going on with all of that. But I think your conversation with him, your debate with him, was excellent. I think you both made a lot of really good points, and it wasn't, you know, this like divisive argument. It was basically, you know, you guys having a discussion, which I thought was really good. And I wanted to talk a little bit about libertarianism because, as you mentioned, you and Cantwell and some of the other guys in the alt-right now that came from a libertarian perspective, you guys were operating in this space and bringing up these basic points about race and Jewish power, and you basically, it sounds like, kind of got ostracized from, you know, I guess more mainstream libertarianism. And I'm curious, I was sort of in, you know, libertarian circles as well with like Ron Paul back when I was first getting involved in all this, but I was never like a hardcore libertarian or that, I guess, concerned with it. I was more kind of like in the anti-war 9/11 truth crowd. But I've always found it interesting. So could you maybe start off by defining libertarianism? Like, how would you explain just the basic concepts to, you know, your average person on the street, I guess?
I would just define libertarianism as a method by which to resolve physical disputes between physically scarce resources. I don't view it as like a overarching political or moral philosophy. I just look at it as a way to reduce the amount of physical conflict in the world between people who are capable of agreeing to and reciprocating private property norms, which when I say private property norms, I mean first use and consensual exchange. We typically think of like ownership, right? Everybody agree. You can't reject the concept of ownership. It's not even possible, because for you to do so would require you to employ your body, right? And then it would prove that you are the owner of your body. So by trying to reject ownership, you would de facto prove that you own your body because you have exclusive control over it at all times. So when I talk, yeah, so libertarianism really just about property rights. Okay. Is there more you want me to say about it, or?
No. So it's all about property rights. It's all about resolving disputes. Could you talk about like the non-aggression principle and maybe some like who is defined your thoughts on libertarianism? Like what sort of like thought leaders, I guess, have you consulted and kind of learned from?
Well, I haven't really consulted with any thought leaders. I was influenced by Ron Paul a lot back in the day, and I've been influenced quite a bit by Stefan Molyneux, but most of my reading was about libertarianism was done through the Mises Institute's online library. So I initially got into Murray Rothbard and then Ludwig von Mises, both Jewish, obviously, and that's how I got my foundational understanding of libertarianism. Though Mises isn't really a libertarian; he just had some ideas that were drawn upon as inspiration for libertarianism. But my main education, I say, came through Hans Hermann Hoppe's work. I would classify myself as like a Hoppean libertarian more than anything.
Okay, yeah. And I know Cantwell is, you know, he mentions Hoppe, and I know he's been kind of influenced by Hoppe as well. I've never read any of his material. I really need to. What could you just cite a couple of his books? I know there's one in particular that always comes up.
There's Democracy, The God That Failed.
Yes.
There's a Theory of Capitalism and Socialism, I believe. There's A Short History of Man. A few other ones as well. A lot of his work is available for free, I think, over at themisesinstitute.org, though. I'm not necessarily enthusiastic about sending people over to that website these days. But for those who are interested, yeah, I mean, you can find a ton like free PDFs by Hans Hermann Hoppe online. And it's not the type of libertarianism where we say, yeah, everybody should be free to do whatever they want. Not the fiscally conservative, socially liberal libertarianism. The type of libertarianism that Hoppe is talking about just reduces everything to property disputes. So if somebody doesn't want you being a homosexual on their property, then they would have the right to kick you off, things like that. And, you know, likewise, if a group of property owners got together and had an entire town or an entire city, an entire county, an entire state, and the purpose of this community was to, for example, provide a future for white, secure a future for white children in the existence of white people. And it was written into, you know, all the property owners in this area agreed that they didn't want homosexuals there, then they would be within their rights to physically remove people for being homosexual. Or, I mean, just as another example, they could not want bronies there. They might not want like My Little Pony conventions for 40-year-old men, and they could do the same thing, or any cultural norm they didn't want. They would have the prerogative to remove people who were advocating it on their property.
That sort of line of thought I totally support, totally agree with. I mean, it's basically like freedom of association. Yeah. That sort of mindset. I completely agree with that. I guess maybe I just haven't read enough libertarian thought, I guess. I've kind of been more involved I've researched more like national socialism, kind of like Heimbach's perspective. And I have a question. I mean, when I hear libertarians talk, I agree with, you know, a lot of what you were saying in the debate and a lot of what I hear from Cantwell. I guess my question, my beef is really the state itself. How would you define the state? And is the state fundamentally illegitimate and tyrannical and unjustified from a libertarian perspective? I mean, what is the, can there ever be, could there ever be a justification for the state?
Depends on the context, right? I mean, in like the abstract compared to an ideal standard, no. But if you have another pressing threat, then maybe, right? I mean, start at the beginning of your question. You said, what is the state, or what is your definition of the state? My definition of the state is a territorial monopoly of ultimate decision making beyond which there is no appeal. So I'm not necessarily against the functions of government, like the production of defense, the production of roads, the production of, you know, health, emergency response services, those types of things. I'm not against those things. I'm against, you know, any one group of people monopolizing those things by saying to their competitors, you're not allowed to enter this market. And if you do, you're going to, you know, have guns pointed at you, essentially. So I'm not necessarily against functions of government. I'm against forceful monopolization, like cartelization is essentially what I'm against.
Okay. No, that makes sense, and I would go along with that. When I mentioned I read Mein Kampf, and, you know, Hitler kind of talks about National Socialism, what it means, and the way he kind of thought about the state, conceptualized the state, it was an organic expression of the broader racial community. So, like, the state was fundamentally tied in with the nation, with the race, and it was an organic expression. So natural leaders of the community would basically assume the responsibilities of the state. And the state was fundamentally designed to advance the interests of the broader community, right? And all of that, to me, makes perfect sense. I think it's a very, you know, developed and sound political, social, economic, and even racial philosophy.
Let me ask you this. If that makes perfect sense, then how does one protect property by expropriating it?
I get, who's expropriating property?
The state.
In what way?
That's what taxation is.
Okay. Well, I guess it would depend on, is it voluntary, or is it sort of like a tyrannical type of taxation, right?
How could it be voluntary? If the consequence for not paying is going to jail, how could it be voluntary? If you're not allowed to shop for a competitor, if you're not allowed to choose who you're hired, it'd be like Netflix saying you have to pay for our service regardless of whether you want it or not, or you're going to jail.
Right. I get you. I mean, I hear you. I guess I'm trying to think of a good response to that. I think you could make a very strong argument that, like, under National Socialism at the time in Germany, the vast majority of the people totally went along with it and totally supported it. And it wasn't this, you know, tyrannical type system where, hey, look, you have to pay taxes to support this, to support that. It was truly a justified system of government. And the state was specifically designed. I mean, its mission was to advance the interests of the broader German community, national community.
The purpose of the state, I mean, that's a Lockean thing. What you're saying is the purpose of the state is to protect the people. But again, I think it's a contradiction in terms to be expropriating property protector. It's like, hey, you need to give me your property so I can defend you, or else I'm going to throw you in jail or kill you.
Now, and, when
I,
you say,
and I can understand
when,
where.
I'm sorry, real quick. Finish. Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I could see where it might be historically necessary to deal with the tools that you have at the time within the context of the conflict that's currently happening, right? With the case in Germany was there's a conflict between themselves and the communists. And, you know, spiritually, the people at that time weren't ready to deal with organize on any basis other than the state. But when we look at the broader – like a broader scope of history, we find that democratic territorial monopolies on ultimate decision making are rather new, and races tended to organize spontaneously without the state. I mean, Hobbes, A Short History of Man, starts back at the agricultural era when men were just emerging from hunter-gatherer type living arrangements to agriculture, and talks about how the process of farming and having to plan for winter and saving naturally led to economic calculation and people associating with each other by means of necessity. We're talking about very small groups of human beings at that point in time, and that's how races developed. So what ended up happening is, as private property owners, some people were more competent than others and acquired more resources than others, to the point where natural aristocracies emerged, where you have a landowner who fundamentally functions as a baron on his property. He's a judge that people go to for conflict resolution, just like you would go to, you know, like you would sue somebody in a court modern day, except the only difference was that this baron on his own property wasn't able to provoke conflicts with people and then appoint himself as the arbiter of those conflicts, which the state is able to do. So as time goes on, you find that you know, you can get a lot of these property owners get together and start to collude, and you get like what's called like a natural monarchy, or somebody declares himself a king of his property, and he organizes all the other property owners and says, okay, swear fealty to me and make me the only judge beyond which there is no appeal, and I'll, you know, reward you with political favors. And that's historically how states tend to form. And then they degrade from there and go from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional monarchy, as is the case in most of Europe, which happened at the beginning of the 20th century. And then it devolves from there into a representative democracy, or a direct democracy, which is what we're seeing now in the United States and Europe. So as things devolve into more direct democracy, we get more degeneracy within our society. We see it now in America, but we also saw it in Weimar Germany. So what these versions of the state that we've been seeing for the last 200 years, they're anything but organic. They're the late stage of social degradation.
Yes, I totally agree with you there. What we see today, the state in America, is certainly not organic by any means. It is a total tyranny. I totally agree with. Are you familiar? Have you read much of like the founding fathers, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, etc.?
Maybe like 10 years ago, but it's not something I really focus on too much because I don't see the utility of it. On one hand, I know there are a group of people who argue the original intent of the founders of America, but my argument for why America belongs to white people is much simpler than that and doesn't require me to know the intent of anybody. My argument is that, again, I accept that taxation is theft. It most definitely, to me, it is theft. It's argumentatively irrefutable. You can't prove that it's not theft. You can say that it's necessary, and we could say, okay, it is necessary if your objective is this, but that doesn't mean it's not theft. So because I accept that taxation is theft, I accept that the people acting as agents of the government are thieves, and that the people that they steal from are owed restitution. Now, this theft has been happening in America since what, before 1776? And there's been heirs, you know, to the property owner since then. People die, they pass their entire estates onto their heirs. That's why you have farms that stay in families forever unless they can't pay the tax bill and the government takes it. So what we have now is a situation in 2018 where the government's run up all this debt, imported all these people, all at the expense of the heirs of the original owners of America. So everything that's been taken from white people through taxation and eminent domain, it should be returned to them restitutively. They have a restitutive claim over the ownership of America. Therefore, it's, even though it's not just, I don't view the existence of a state as justified in an absolute sense, I still think it would be more preferable for the state to be used to deport non-whites who've showed up since 1965 than it would be for just pretend like it doesn't exist. I'm going to monopolize immigration controls and border controls and then lay down on the job. That's basically what it's doing when you have open borders. And the libertarians will incorrectly argue that open borders is the same as the government not doing anything, but it's not. If the government wasn't doing anything, private producers of defense could maintain borders on their own. That's not what happens. What happens is the government prevents them from doing that by monopolizing the production of the service and then punishing people who try to compete with it. So what they do, but after they monopolize it, they lay down on the job, they expose white Americans to all this demographic change. It's a form of theft and they owe restitution for it. I don't buy the Hitlerian argument that the people are the state, because if the people are the state, then the people are responsible for everything the state does. It would mean that you and I owe reparations to Iraqis for the Iraq war. I had nothing to do with that, right? You had nothing to do with that, right?
Right, right. Yeah, there's two issues I want to bring up. I mentioned, sure. I asked if you are familiar with the Founding Fathers or read any, you know.
I know we got far off. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no. It's okay. I brought that up because I think if you read a lot of what they were saying at the time, they talked about the role of virtue in society and in politics and this sort of you know, honesty and decency and having like Christian principles. And they argue that if you lost that sort of virtue in politics and in society, it would degrade. And I think that is very, very true, that we have lost all sort of virtue, especially in politics. I mean, we have the most sleazy, disgusting criminals basically running our government, running for office, by and large anyways. I mean, almost all of them, like to a man. You know, or yeah. Woman for that matter. So we've totally lost virtue in society. And I think if you compare like the early founding fathers and people involved in, you know, early American history to today, I mean, it's like night and day. You know, these people had a sense of virtue. They had a sense of honesty and decency, and they were trying to do what was right. Where now, you know, the people involved in government, they're just out there to make money. They're trying to get rich. They're trying to advance the interests of the people that are paying for their campaigns and stuff like that. So it's totally out of control.
Well,
I'm just curious, go ahead.
I'm sorry, ask your question. I'll just wrap my point into the answer.
I guess my point is that I think this idea of having virtue in society and in politics is a huge thing, and we've lost that, and that's why we see all this corruption and criminality and degeneracy today.
Maybe.
I
certainly wouldn't disagree that the Founding Fathers are a bit more virtuous than what we have today for rulers, but I would take issue, I think, with the suggestion or the implicit suggestion that they weren't motivated by self-interest, because they definitely were. They were starting a territorial monopoly over the production of defense and ultimate decision-making. It was necessarily going to confer lots of power onto them. I think they were motivated by self-interest and greed and profit. And I don't think that they were necessarily selfless.
I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. I think they certainly were self-motivated, but I think there were other considerations as well. What's good for our country? What's good for our people?
Yeah, I mean that those questions, in a sense, are like saying what's good for GDP, right? They're like aggregate measurements of benefit, like psychological benefit. You can't really predict that for every individual. Nobody can, right? So when you say what's good for our people or what's good for our folk, and I'm not necessarily against doing things that are good for the race, but nobody's necessarily in a position to say what anyone else's preferences should be, even if they are both members of the same race, right? I wouldn't want you. I mean, you seem like a good guy. We seem to agree on a lot of stuff, but I wouldn't necessarily want you to have ultimate decision making over my property, right?
Sure. Yeah, no, I hear you. It's a good point. One other thing I wanted to bring up relating to taxation. So your argument basically is that taxation itself, like the concept, is a form of theft no matter what.
Yes. Is that,
okay.
Yep.
Now, what about someone – this isn't necessarily how I feel, but what about somebody who would argue that I view taxation as voluntary. I'm willing to give up my tax money to pay to the government to provide certain services – protection, national defense, you know, roads, et cetera, whatever. What would you say to somebody who totally viewed it the opposite as you, as some sort of voluntary and legitimate and justified form of, I guess, I don't know, I guess just payment to provide a service?
Well, I'd say a couple things. It doesn't really necessarily matter if they view it as voluntary, because if they choose not to do it, then they're still going to be punished. But another thing is like, I am perfectly willing to voluntarily pay for those services. I think the services themselves are necessary. I just don't think it's necessary for their provision to be monopolized, right? So it's you could say
monopolized by the state.
Right, right. Or by anybody. But usually when you find a monopoly, you find government intervention. So, but yeah, I forgot exactly what I was going to say. If you have another question, we can continue.
No, I this is all very interesting. And it's like, I need to really think about this a lot more. I mean, because I think there is a lot of overlap with like libertarian thought, national socialism. I think, you know, I mean, there's obviously going to be some differences, but I think there's probably more common ground than we realize. Have you ever read Mein Kampf?
No, I haven't. I'm familiar with it, and I'm familiar with the ideology of like the George Lincoln Rockwell type Natsocs. And one of the things I really like about where they're coming from is the private property ethic, right? Because that is something that I value very much as a libertarian. That's the entire point of libertarianism, is that private property ethic. Now, my only contention really with National Socialism is the fact that National Socialism establishes a monopolist who has the right to trespass against your property under the auspices of protecting you. And I'm not unwilling to pay for protection, but I don't want to be trespassed against for not choosing a particular protection agency, is all I'm saying. I don't see why white people have to have a single country. I don't see why white people should be forced to share a single producer of territorial defense. I don't see why white people can't have multiple competing agencies all producing territorial defense who can divide labor when attacked by outsiders. That's essentially what the original American states were before the federal government was formed. When we fought against the British, we didn't have a federal government. We had all these different states coordinating and dividing labor, and they each had their own territorial monopoly. But if I mean, to be honest with you, like, as you know, part of being a Hoppian libertarian means I'm trying to affect secessions. I think white people are going to be stronger, and the more political units we have, because the more political units we have, the more places that our enemies have to take out. Right now, all they have to do is subvert Washington, D.C., and we're fucked the country over. If the federal government went away tomorrow, they'd have to deal with every one of our states individually. So white states like Maine and New Hampshire would be infinitely more safer. And if a white state like Maine wants to split into two or three pieces, three individual nations, and keep going that way, I don't see anything wrong with that. Because again, all a system of government is a monopoly on decision making. You don't necessarily have to have a monopoly on decision making to get decisions made. And I think that white people, I agree with the idea of protecting the interests of white people. That's why I don't want to expropriate their property under the name of protecting them. I want them to have an option on who they pay for protection, because I think that's part of what makes white society so great. And I think it's part of what got us to the place where we're at now, is you didn't necessarily have to depend on the government, right? We have a strong tradition of gun ownership, Second Amendment laws. And I think that's the same idea. A monopoly on the ownership of guns has a single point of failure, which is the government. We wouldn't tolerate a monopoly on the ownership of guns, so why would we tolerate a monopoly on the production of defense?
Sure. Yeah, no, I hear you. You're making a lot of sense, for sure. I do have one other topic I wanted to bring up, I guess. And that's this idea of the individual versus the collective. And from a libertarian perspective, from your perspective, what responsibility is there a responsibility? What responsibility does the individual have towards the broader collective community? And I'm specifically talking about like a broader racial community. As a white individual, is there any sort of responsibility that you have towards the broader community from your perspective?
Yeah, probably. I mean, not on the grounds of libertarianism, but my entire worldview isn't informed by libertarianism. My libertarianism only informs my method, the means by which I resolve property disputes. It's it's entirely the case that, you know, a lot of individuals are going to have responsibility to several individuals within their community. I myself have a responsibility to my son. I have a responsibility to my fiance. I have responsibility to my family. I have responsibilities to my employers, to my customers. I have responsibilities to all kinds of people. Now, you could ask, do you have a responsibility to the race in general? And I think that's kind of a tricky question, because there are members of my race that want me dead because of my race. There are members of my race who want me dead because they want my property. I don't think I necessarily have a responsibility to those people. But then one more complication is the fact that we're all biologically limited by what's called Dunbar's number, which means we can only maintain relationships with a finite number of people. We can only know a certain amount of people. And if I can only know a certain amount of people, I can only serve a certain amount of people. How can I fulfill my responsibility to people I don't know? So I would agree that individuals have a responsibility to individuals in their community. I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's all it ever is. You're not interfacing with some faceless, nameless blob called the race. You're interfacing with other individuals. And I take that very seriously. It's something that came up in my debate with Matthew Heimbach, like family values. And I don't think, you know, when I talk about libertarianism, I'm talking about political individualism, where we talk about who has the right to control what. But I don't think that precludes a responsibility to others. We voluntarily incur such responsibilities all the time. People do us favors, so we do them favors. We put our kids into a state of incapacity just by giving birth to them. And we, for 18 years, we take care of them because we have a responsibility to our communities, to our children, to our race, to continue our gene sets into the next generation. I don't think anything about libertarianism precludes concern for the broader group.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, no, that's very well said. And I think from like a national socialist perspective, I completely agree with everything you said. I think it does start with your, you know, your basic familial responsibilities, right, and then it kind of extends from there. I guess, you know, reading Mein Kampf and kind of studying national socialism, it's a very, in my opinion, a very well thought out and very well articulated political and social and economic and racial philosophy. Yeah. So I guess it's maybe just more broader, all encompassing than libertarianism.
I don't know about that. Maybe it does cover more of the cultural stuff, but I mean, a lot of the cultural stuff could be justified under libertarianism just within the context of private property norms. Like, this is what we as a people want on our property. But I think libertarianism and national socialism both suffer from the same problem, in that they're insufficient as the basis of a group identity. Right? We don't identify ideologically usually. I mean, there are certain cultural norms that emerge that within white communities that are common to all white communities, which is why you see the private property ethic in both national socialism and libertarianism. But we don't necessarily organize our social units on those basis. So I think we organize primarily on genetic proximity, physical proximity, culture. I mean, there's different white cultures even. I mean, the culture you find in France is not the same culture you find in Britain or Ireland, or even the culture you find in Maine is not the same culture you find in Oregon. So, I mean,
exactly.
I think we organize on those bases first, or bases rather. And I think that libertarianism and national socialism are both insufficient as the basis for group identity. We need something more. We need something that's more concrete. These things, they're both well thought out, but they take a long time to explain to people, as evidenced by this conversation, right? I think something that is more innate to people is just in-group preference, like siding with people who look like you. It's a visceral, natural thing that babies do. Even babies have better responses to people of their own race than of people of other race. So I think if we're going to organize on any basis, it's going to be primarily by race and ethnicity, because that's what people do. And then if people demonstrate like ideological tendencies that you would find undesirable, like maybe you've got white people in your community, but they're communist, which I'm sure you know, as a national socialist, you as a national socialist, me as a libertarian, we could both agree that communists are bad regardless of what color they are. But we're not going to necessarily organize our community on the basis of being anti-communist.
Right. Well, I think it's got to be, to put it very, very simply, especially now in our current context, it's got to be just, are you pro-white or anti-white? You know, that's the bottom line.
Right.
We could keep it as simple as that. Do you support the idea of white people existing and thriving And well, having,
at least for the
having
context a, of America, right?
Yeah,
because we need to make America white again. But if the question becomes something else, if the question becomes should Maine and New Hampshire have the right to leave the nation, and it's like, okay, it doesn't matter if they're pro-white or anti-white at that point because they're more than 90% white.
Yeah,
by a fact, and the biggest threat to their demographic integrity is membership in the union, because the federal government can just say, okay, now you have to take all these Somalis that we just imported through Minnesota, and because they came in through Minnesota, you have a right to accept them too, and that at a certain point becomes a liability, right? And
yeah,
I don't know. Well, that's why we're gonna need more. We're gonna need a bunch of secessions, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's kind of difficult to predict what's gonna happen. I mean, at this point, I just don't see how this is sustainable. I mean, unless it's just – and we basically do see this right now, this just absolute boot-in-your-face Jewish tyranny, shut you down, get you fired, ruin your life. You know, that's basically what we're seeing today. I mean, maybe it certainly – I think it could get worse. I mean, it's pretty bad. You've seen so many people lose their jobs, lose their friendships. You know, it goes on and on. Lose their websites, for God's sake. You can't raise money. You can't use PayPal.
You know, the thing is, though, is you can only dox people once. You can only do that to people. You can only do that to people once, like, you know, destroy all their relationships. And the relationships they build after that are going to survive that information. So – I think, if anything, that they're only going to get more of the Streisand effect. The more they try to censor us, the more it's going to create market opportunities for us to network with each other, to provide competing, you know, platforms, technological platforms. And they're the authors of their own demise, I think. I don't think that their failure is inevitable. I think we have a lot to work to do. So I don't think we should get too far ahead of ourselves. But I don't think the anti-white left is doing itself any favors by constantly trying to gaslight white people or call people white supremacist Nazis for things as, I don't know, innocuous as saying it's okay to be white, right? I mean, they're going to try to get you fired from your job and call you a racist if you think it's okay to be white. Like, that's literally what we've gotten to at this point.
Oh, yeah, man. It's out of control. Well, and I think, you know, with Trump getting in the White House, just him running for office in the first place, and then him ultimately winning the presidency, that coupled with the, you know, the rise of the alt-right and our ideas getting more and more attention and the movement getting more and more attention and coverage, and, you know, more and more people are learning about our ideas. I think things are definitely going in our direction and going in the right direction. Of course, there's going to be setbacks and, you know, crazy shit's going to come up and happen. But ultimately, I think things are going in our direction, and I'm encouraged by it all, especially with the way the alt-right has been kind of able to insert itself in the national conversation and kind of make a spectacle from from time to time and really just get in the media and get in people's faces. I think that's all very, very good, and I'd like to know your thoughts about sort of just the alt-right in general.
I don't know. I think the alt-right's got a lot of problems. I'm not pessimistic about it, but I think there is some stuff that needs to be worked out. There is, you know, there's this whole idea that first you can't criticize anybody within the alt-right if you're on the alt-right, but then you got people criticizing people for criticizing people, thereby becoming the object of their criticism, ironically. I think in general, people need to stop doing what the libertarians do and trying to, what's the word for it, cannibalize each other's followings, because I don't think it's really helping. If there's somebody who's not necessarily, if their tactic is something you don't disagree with, I would say it's better to just ignore them and focus your energy on taking down some Antifa chicken swinger, not in a physical sense. I'm not saying that anybody should go do anything illegal, but if you want to invest your effort and energy into something and helping the white race, then it shouldn't be invested into like attacking pro-white advocates, is all I'm saying. I think maybe the alt-right is at a crossroads. I think it's constantly evolving. I think there's a lot of people that wanted it to be explicitly national socialist, but I don't think that's going to happen, because essentially it's a white identitarian movement, and most white people don't take their own side. Or they don't take their own side because of the word socialism. That generally just doesn't happen, except maybe in like younger generations. So I think the alt-right's at a crossroads. I think most of the disagreement in the alt-right's most based around branding and optics. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think the process of hashing this out is ultimately going to make the white identitarian movement stronger, as long as they don't, you know, make criticizing each other the hill they want to die on. I think that we should definitely be more intelligent about where we invest our energy. But I think, I don't know. I'm optimistic, but I'm scared. You know, we're not winning the demographic battle by any means. There are states in the United States that are huge liabilities, and I'm focused more right now on getting people accepting of the idea of secession, because I think if we want to exist as white people in white states, secession's probably going to be the place where we have to start. I don't think we're going to get the mass deportations we're all hoping for.
Right, at least not anytime soon. It's going to be a huge uphill battle, no doubt. I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think it's going to have to start sort of at like a local community level, developing local communities, you know, and taking over territory. I know Cantwell talks about that all the time, and I think really it is kind of the only way forward, or at least the most productive way forward.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's interesting being in like the pro-white movement for so long. I mean, there's ever since I've kind of been involved with it, there's always been this all this drama and people talking shit. I mean, it comes with the territory. It's really kind of frustrating and annoying. At this point I just ignore it all, basically. I kind of just try to do my own thing. But I want to echo what you said, and you know, please think about what you're doing. Is it something that's going to be productive, or are you just gossiping and talking shit on the internet about
people? Even in your own personal life too, it's not even just the gossiping stuff, but like the way you conduct yourself. I totally agree. If you know you're perceived as a thought leader in the movement, try to make yourself as squeaky clean as possible, because like the things we saw that happened this week are definitely not things that helped us in the short term. They might provide advantages in the long term, but it created a sense of disunity in the short term that I don't think anybody really thinks is worth it, right? So yeah, be on top of your game. Don't betray each other. Don't stab each other in the back. Don't do anything that's going to make everybody else fucking, you know, have to deal with unnecessary burdens. I'm not trying to optics cut and say you should never do anything to make anybody else look bad, because it's impossible, right? We just spent how long talking about how saying it's okay to be white is going to get you called a Nazi white supremacist. It's impossible to make yourself look good to these people, but don't give them the bait they need to cast us as like Jewish Hollywood cartoon character Nazis. That's really all I'm saying, dude. We can appeal to the interests of white people a lot better, and people could say, oh, well, you just want to make it normie friendly. It's not necessarily what I'm doing, but at the end of the day, we're going to need some of those normies on our side, because it's the normies not being on our side is why we're losing this battle to the Jews as it stands. Because on their own, Jews don't have what it takes to beat us. Blacks don't have what it takes to beat us. Even the mestizos don't either. The only reason the anti-white left is beating us is because they have the cooperation of the white left, right?
So yeah. Only the white left, I mean, just our established political establishment in general, in the way people think, they control the narrative largely. And really, my goal is helping white people achieve moral clarity, you know, on these issues, on these racial issues, on historical issues. Yeah. 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 No, I mean, I'm not opposed to that at all. I mean, I think it's good that there's multiple people, you know, approaching this stuff from multiple perspectives. I think that's very good.
But you're right. And that's what it's all about. Moral clarity or whatever. People have to have the moral certainty to take their own side, and it sucks. But white people won't take their own side, even as they're being exterminated, if they don't have moral certainty. And that's what concerns me about the National Socialism thing, is I know it works on a lot of people. Like, a lot of people get really interested into it. It's a method by which people get red-pilled on race, because they realize, hey, I was lied to about the Holocaust. But there are a lot of people out there who don't get that same moral certainty for it. And that's why I think it's good to have people like me and Cantwell coming at it from a more libertarian perspective, because, you know, I know American nationalism is pretty cucky in the present, but it wasn't when it started. And there's a lot of people who still identify with like what America originally was and present, you know, libertarianism is rooted in the English common law tradition, which is the backbone of the entire American judicial system, which is still part of our culture, believe it or not. I mean, like this idea of keep your word, do no harm. Like that's the fundamental basis of our legal system. And it's something that people identify with. So I don't know, man, whatever it takes to get, like you said, to give more white people the moral certainty to take their own side is what we need in the short term.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I think you're doing a great job and I want to encourage you to continue your work and to keep it up. Can you plug your website and maybe your Twitter and Gab feeds as well?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter for now. It's at Real Jared Howe, though I don't post there very often because I assume that most of the people interacting with me either already agree with me or that my account's going to get deleted soon. But you can find me on gab.ai at Jared Howe. I'm also on a handful of other platforms, iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher. My podcast is called So to Speak, and you can find that directly on my website. It's jaredhowe.net.
Very good. And I will have links to your social media and, of course, to your website where you guys can check out Jared's work. It's also syndicated by Chris Cantwell. I subscribe to his RSS feed, and all your shows come up right there in that feed. So it's a very good and easy way to listen to two great podcasts. Right.
Yeah, Chris is great. I think you can also, just to drop their name, I think you can also find my podcast at The Daily Stormer, the radicalcapitalist.org, and the revolutionaryconservative.com. So there's a few different options you have there.
Cool. Well, Jared, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate you coming on and taking the time. I think it was a very interesting discussion. And, you know, again, ultimately, I think there's a lot of overlap and I think we agree more than we disagree on a lot of these, you know, issues when it comes to political philosophy. And it's interesting. I think it's fascinating hearing you out from a, you know, kind of a libertarian perspective. I can't say I disagree with pretty much everything you're saying. It's a very interesting discussion to have. So we'll have to do it again in the future.
Yeah, let's. I enjoyed myself. Again, thanks for having me. It was good to talk to you, man.
All right, buddy. Have a good one. We will talk to you soon.
Take it easy.
All right.